Up to this point, we have come to the betrayal of Jesus, then his being taken in to trial at the court of the high priest. So we're going to look at the trial, and along with that, we're going to look at the betrayal of Peter, and also the conclusion of the story of Judas. And then from that point on, we go to the trial before Pilate and the condemnation, the way to the cross, and then the crucifixion. Are there any questions about any of the material that we've covered up to this point? Okay. In St. Mark's Gospel, this is on page 35 of your parallel copy of the Gospel text. It says, "They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed at a distance right up into the courtyard of the high priest, and there he sat with the guards and warmed himself by the fire." So what Mark has them do is immediately after the arrest of Jesus in Gethsemane, he is taken to the high priest. And it says all the chief priests. Remember last week we talked about how sometimes people of the house of Annas would serve for a year or two and then they'd be put aside because they were not favorable to the Roman authorities, and some other person from the family would step in and fulfill that role. So there were a variety of people who had exercised the role of chief priest. And so we're told in Mark's Gospel that those folks were there, as well as the elders, the wealthy leading citizens of Jerusalem were the elders and the teachers of the law. We're told that in verse 55, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, and many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. That there was the desire from the very beginning to find him guilty and to condemn him. Now remember, we had talked about how the issues that they raised against Jesus in the trial were not the same issues that were raised against him in his public life. In his public life, he was soundly criticized because he didn't observe the Sabbath. He was criticized because he did not have his disciples fast the way the Pharisees' disciples fasted. He was criticized because he did not observe the religious rules and regulations. And principally he was criticized because he was embracing those people who were on the fringe. He ate with tax collectors and sinners. Now those are not the issues that arise in the trial. The issue principally that arises in the trial is that this man said he would destroy this temple and in 3 days rebuild it. That's the accusation that they bring against him. So it is Jesus' violation of the temple and Jesus' announcement that he is above the temple that is the accusation that is brought against him. Now remember last week we talked about the temple as being very significant, very, very significant, not only to the religious life, but to the economic life of Jerusalem. That fully one-third of the population of Jerusalem made their living in one way or another in businesses or enterprises that were temple-related. The temple wasn't only the place of worship. The temple was the place of education. The temple was the place of commerce. The temple was the center of the economic, social, political, and religious life of the people of Jerusalem. And so a huge number of people had an investment in the temple. No one had a greater investment in the the temple than the chief priests. No one had a greater investment than the chief priests. For they were the ones who oversaw. They were the ones who were in charge of the temple. And so it is, the trial is taking place before the chief priests and the elders of Jerusalem. And so the accusation is around the temple and not around those other issues. We'll almost never see references to the Pharisees in the story of the suffering and the dying of Jesus. All those references come from earlier in the public life. These are references to the chief priests and the elders of the people, to the Sanhedrin, to the ruling court of Jerusalem. I recall also last week we spoke about the Sanhedrin as not being a sitting body, not like a Senate or a legislature. The Sanhedrin was called together for a purpose, was convened for a purpose. Something happens, something emerges, something occurs, and there's a need to have a judgment rendered. And so the chief priests and the elders and the scribes, they are called, and they're called to sit in judgment. Now this call went out in the night, and so it's reasonable to assume that probably not a large number of people assembled. This was a call that went out at night. It was an emergency call. It roused people out of their homes, out of their beds. There probably were not a huge number of people present. They bring testimony against him in the 57th verse of St. Mark. Some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will build another not made with human hands. Yet even then their testimony did not agree. Now Mark says this is false testimony, but he doesn't tell us why it's false. He does not say why he regards this, or why they regarded this, or probably why he regards this as false testimony. I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will build another not made with human hands. From the earliest time, the church has looked upon itself in a number of metaphors or a number of similes, and one of those images that the church has taken to itself to describe itself is the temple of God's presence, that the church is the new temple. And the temple is made not of stones, of physical stones, but the temple is made of, if you will, human stones. The temple is made up of the members of the body of Christ. And so the image that is present here in Mark could well be an image that underlies that understanding of the temple. I will destroy this temple made by hands. I will destroy this physical temple. And in 3 days, I will raise up a temple not made by hands, not physical, a spiritual temple. In the 60th verse, we're told that the high priest stood up before them and he asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and he gave no answer. And again the chief priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed? Jesus is asked, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed? In many ways, it's two separate questions. Now, the understanding of the Messiah was that the Messiah would come, this leader would come, this leader of the house of David would come, and would restore the Davidic line. That the Messiah's job was to restore the kingship of David. And Jesus wrestled with this throughout his public life because that's the way his contemporaries and his disciples understood Messiah. And Jesus was at pains to say, no, this is not the kingdom I come to found. In St. Mark's Gospel, after Jesus talks about the kingdom and after he does the signs of the kingdom, the healings, he tells his disciples, now don't tell anyone what you've seen. That strikes us as curious. And yet what he's saying to them is, you don't understand what's going on. You still have this attitude that the Messiah is the one who is going to restore the kingship, that it is an earthly kingdom. That's what you're thinking. So don't talk about these signs, because I don't want to have to deal with that with all these other people as well. So Jesus is very, very suspect and quite cagey about answering the question of, are you the Messiah? And so he doesn't answer, if you will, that question. Are you the Son of the Blessed One? Now that's a different question. That's a different question. Are you the Son of God? Do you claim to be equal to God? That's a very, very different question. And that question Jesus answers. I am, he says. Now remember, those words, I am, are those ancient, deeply rooted words by which God, in his revelation to Moses, defined himself and gave his name. Who shall I tell the people has sent me? Well, you tell them I am has sent you. Jesus' use of those words is not lost on the chief priests and the elders. Are you the Son of the Blessed One? I am, Jesus says. And then he goes on to say, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming in the clouds of heaven. Now let's look at the comparisons that are found in the other Gospels. Now in Matthew, and Matthew will add just a very few pieces to Mark that kind of fill out the Markan story. Those who had arrested Christ took him to Caiaphas, the high priest. So Matthew tells us the name of the high priest. Mark does not. Where the teachers of the law and the elders assembled. But Peter followed at a distance right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. Now the chief priests of the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false testimony, false evidence against Jesus, so that they might put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared. Now again, Matthew specifies. Mark just has witnesses coming forward. Matthew indicates that two came forward. This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. But the high priest stood up and said, what are you going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? And once again, as in Mark, as in Matthew, Jesus remained silent. And then the high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. And Jesus responds not by answering him. Jesus throws it back to him. And he's going to do this again with Pilate. Jesus says, well, you're the one who said so. And then he says, but now I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. So Jesus doesn't answer directly the question of the high priest. But as in Mark, Jesus testifies that what you will see now is the Son of Man. That's the word that Mark uses, and that's also the word that Matthew uses. Coming on the clouds of heaven, coming in judgment, the image of coming on the clouds of heaven is the image of the final reconciliation, the final judgment of God. We find that image also in the 25th chapter of St. Matthew, where he talks about the final coming, where at the end of time, the Son of Man will come on the clouds with all the angels, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people as a shepherd separates sheep from goats, the just on his right and the wicked on his left. So again, that image of coming in the clouds is Jesus saying that you truly will see the Son of Man, you truly will see me come in judgment. And then both in Matthew and in Mark, we see the chief priest's response, and it's the same one. Then the high priest tore his clothes, and in Matthew, he says, he has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they cry out, he is worthy of death. In Mark, the high priest tears his garments and says, why do we need any more witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And here in Mark, again, we don't have the actual words that were spoken. We just have, and they all condemned him as one worthy of death. Whereas Matthew has the words, he is worthy of death, placed in the mouths of the scribes and the elders. Blasphemy. Technically, blasphemy has to do with a very specific, category. Acting or speaking irreligiously. As time moved on, it became more and more refined. So that ultimately, blasphemy had to do with either a direct affront to God, a cursing of God, for instance, or a pretending to have the power of God. And that's clearly what they're saying of Jesus. That this person is blasphemous because this person claims to have the power of God. The power of God being the one who comes in judgment. Now in Matthew and in Mark, it is the members of the Sanhedrin who mock Jesus. In Mark, then some of them began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, they struck him with their fists, and they said, prophesy. And the guards stood, and the guards took him and beat him. So the mocking, the spitting, the slapping, the striking, the pummeling is being done by the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. In St. Matthew it says, "Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists." So the spitting and the striking is being done by the members of the Sanhedrin. And Matthew says that others then slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Messiah, who hit you?" So in Mark, it is the court that is doing all of this. In Matthew, it is members of the court and then others. Other people who were there. And those others aren't named. They're just others. Okay, now let's look at Luke. Now Luke does not have a trial. There is no trial in Luke. There is an interrogation that takes place. And so we're told in Luke's Gospel, they seized him, that is Jesus, and they led him away, and they took him into the house of the high priest. In the others, we're told they took him to the high priest. And we're told that Peter was in the courtyard outside. In Luke, they take him to the residence of the high priest. They take him to the house of the high priest. And then they go, and then in Luke, you go right into Peter's denial. In Matthew and Mark, there is the apprehension, there is the trial, and then there's the denial. In Luke, there's the apprehension, there's the denial, and then there's the interrogation. So if we go to on page 36, pardon me, on page 37, we're told that the men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And they said many other insulting things to him as well. So, in Luke, Jesus is captured. He's taken to the house of the high priest. Peter is denying him, and while Peter is denying him, there is this abuse that is going on. And the abuse is from those who were guarding him. The abuse is not from the Sanhedrin, the chief priests, the elders. It's from those who were guarding him began to mock him. And then we're told in verse 66, "And then at daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them." So in Luke, the trial takes place in the morning, not at night. It's a very significant difference. Because those who have argued about the falseness of the trial, one of the arguments they have is that this is a kangaroo court. You arrest somebody in the middle of the night, you bring them into court, you see who you can gather together at the last minute, you try the person and you condemn the person, and it's all done before daybreak. But that's not a real court of justice. Luke tells a different story. Luke says that he was apprehended, he was jailed, he was guarded during the night, he was granted, he was abused, he was slapped, he was treated very poorly, and then in the morning the court was convened. Jesus was led before them. "If you are the Messiah," they said, "tell us." once again, Jesus doesn't answer them. If I were to tell you, you will not believe me, and if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. So he won't answer the question of the Messiah. He says, if I answer you, you won't believe it anyway. So why should I bother to tell you about it? And then they asked him, are you the Son of God? And Jesus refuses to answer that question in Mark. He just says, you say that I am. But that was enough for them. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from our own lips. And that's the end of the trial story in Luke. There is no condemnation that is made. There's no place in the story that says he is guilty of death. Or there's no place in the story that says, what shall we do with him? He has blasphemed. He is guilty of death. Luke does not have a condemnation point. And in fact, there are those who have said that in the strictest sense of the word, these probably were not trials. In the strictest sense of the word, these were probably interrogations. Or we have the experience in, you know, in American legal system of a grand jury, where a person is brought before a grand jury and questions are asked, and only after that is an indictment given. So it's a fact-finding thing. And it's only then after the grand jury experience that the trial takes place. And some would say that what happened in the house of the high priest or in the court of the high priest was an interrogation. It was a grand jury interrogation. And what they did is they did find him guilty. They found enough evidence to say that this man should stand trial. And then what they all did is, in all the Gospels, what they did was then they handed him over to the Roman governor, where the trial takes place. So there are some who will comment on the story, and they will say that that there are really two trials that take place. There's a religious trial and there's a Roman trial. Others will say, no, there was an interrogation that the religious community undertook. And then they bound him over for trial. Now, before we finish this part, let's go to John. John says, they brought him first to Annas, who was the father of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. Now remember, that piece takes place in the Palm Sunday story. That Jesus enters Jerusalem and the people take up the palms and they claim him as the Messiah, the Son of David. And that this is being watched by the chief priest, Annas and Caiaphas. Remember, Annas is the family of Annas out of which the chief priests are arising at this time. And they see what's happening and Caiaphas says that it would be good, it would be appropriate, if one man died for the people. Now for John, there are two ways of understanding that sentence. John is saying is that for Caiaphas it was, in order to preserve the nation, in order to preserve our nation as it is, in order to not raise the hackles of the Romans, it's important that one man die. It's important that this man die. But as John puts these words on Caiaphas' lips, the word for means in behalf of. It is good that that one man die in behalf of the people. One man die in the name of the people. One man die for the salvation of the people. And so John sees from the lips of Caiaphas a statement that clearly can be taken two ways. And John sees that second way as, if you will, the prophesying that the high priest does without his even knowing it. Then we're told that Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Now this other disciple is a very curious fellow. This other disciple is found four times in the Gospel. This other disciple is the one who sits next to Jesus at the Last Supper. He's not given a name. He just said it's another disciple. This other disciple is the one who stands at the foot of the cross. Again, he's not given a name. We, in tradition, have given him the name John, but the scriptures don't. The scriptures refer to him simply as the other disciple or the disciple whom Jesus loved, but not a name. And the fourth place the other disciple shows up is at the tomb on Easter morning. Word is being brought to the disciples that he is risen, and Peter and the other disciple leave immediately and they run to the tomb, and the other disciple outruns Peter, and he gets to the tomb and he looks in, but he doesn't enter. And Peter arrives and Peter goes in first, and then the other disciple goes in, and the other disciple sees the white cloth with which Jesus had been wrapped, and the cloth that was over his face separated from the other clothing. And then we're told, he saw and he believed. Now, tradition has named this person John. But there is no evidence in the scripture that this is John. This is the other disciple, or called the disciple whom Jesus loved. Now, what role does that other disciple have? Well, remember, for Mark, the story of the Passion of Jesus is a very dark story. Everyone abandons him. And in fact, there is that progressive abandonment that takes place. First, the large group of disciples leave him, then Peter, James, and John leaves him, then finally, even that disciple who was on the fringe runs away at the end. So, for Mark, it's a story of abandonment. Now remember, we also said that in John, Jesus is always in charge. This is the royal Jesus. This is the sovereign. Remember that scene in the garden? It's not that those who come to arrest him ask him questions. He asks them questions. Who have you come for? Jesus the Nazarene. I am he. And when he says, I am he, they fall to the ground. In the other stories, Jesus falls to the ground. In John, the soldiers fall to the ground. Jesus frees his disciples in John's Gospel. He says, well, if you're looking for me, then let these other ones go. So in John's Gospel, they don't run away. Jesus dismisses them. Jesus is always in charge in the story of the Passion in John's Gospel. Well, what function does the other disciple have? The other disciple has the function of the counterpoint to Mark. This is the one who did not run away. This is the one who was with Jesus at the supper of the Lord when Jesus foretold, "I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." This is the one who is with Jesus in Gethsemane and comes to the home of the high priest. This is the one who stands under the cross. And this is the one who is the first of the disciples to believe. This is the one who is at the tomb. So this one stands for John as the counterpoint to the disciples in Mark. This is the faithful disciple. Now we're also told in John, Simon Peter and the other disciple were following Jesus because this disciple was known to the high priest. He went in with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. This disciple was known to the high priest. This disciple had a relationship with the high priest. This disciple did not have to be introduced. He went with Jesus right into the courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside at the door. So Peter was kept at the gate. And this other disciple, with Jesus and with the group of soldiers, went into the courtyard. And then it says, the other disciple who was known to the high priest came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. So he goes in with Jesus, and he notices that Peter's at the gate yet. So he goes out and he has a conversation with the gatekeeper, with the servant girl who's taking care of the gate. And then on his word, on the word of this disciple, Peter is allowed into the courtyard. Well, this is a very, very curious guy, this disciple. He's got relationships that none of the other disciples have. Now, there's nothing in the scriptures that says that the high priest knew that this person was a disciple of Jesus. That's not what it says. It says that he was known to the high priest, that he had a personal relationship. Doesn't mean that the high priest knew everything about him. So maybe the man had a double life. The scriptures don't tell us any of that. But it's curious that one of the 12 had that kind of relationships. Now this only comes in John's Gospel. There's no mention of this person in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. It's a unique addition to the story that is found in John. Now in Matthew and Mark, while Jesus is being interrogated, tried, there are the three denials of Peter. In Luke, there is no trial, there is no interrogation, there is just the denial of Peter. In John, there is the first denial of Peter, then the trial, then the second and third denial. So it's seen differently. The scenario, the drama is played out differently. We're going to skip the piece of the denial of Peter and John and come back to that after we talk about the questions of the high priest. So in the bottom of page 36, number 19, verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest questions Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. In John, the questioning is about the disciples and about the teaching. And Jesus goes immediately on the offensive. I have spoken openly to the world, Jesus replies. I have always taught in the synagogue or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I have said. There are some commentators who have found it curious, have found this language curious. I always taught in the synagogues or in the temple where all the Jews come together. It is almost as if Jesus has separated himself from the nation. It's almost as if Jesus has an understanding of himself that is broader than, or deeper than, or higher than, or wider than the others. There's nothing really to give a clear demonstration of that, but it is a curious way of speaking, as if he's not included in the Jews. Now when Jesus had said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. So again, he is slapped. This by one of the officials. But he is slapped not in mockery, that's what the other slappings were about. He was slapped because of his disrespect for the high priest. Is this the way you answer the high priest? Again, Jesus is playing a very strong role in John's gospel. He's not intimidated at all by this. And even after the slap, Jesus confronts the official. If I said something wrong, testify as to what is wrong. If I have spoken the truth, why do you strike me? And then we're simply told that Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus comes before Caiaphas. In John, he is brought first to the father-in-law, the head of the family. He's brought first to Annas. And only afterward, after Annas questions him, then does Annas send him on to the high priest that year, to Caiaphas. So we've got at least three very different pictures. Matthew and Mark are very close to each other. Matthew has a few details that Mark doesn't have. But it's pretty much the same scenario. It's pretty much the same questions. It's pretty much the same action. Luke is different. Luke really has no trial. He's got Jesus held by guards overnight. During this time in Luke is when the denial of Peter takes place. And for Luke, the denial of Peter is a much longer piece. I mean, he's got a whole night to figure to play that in. And there's a unique touch in Luke's story of the denial of Peter that isn't present in any of the others. And in John we have a very different picture of Jesus, and in John we have a very different picture of the interrogation. He's being interrogated about his teachings, and he's being interrogated about his disciples. Okay, now we move to the denial of Peter. In Mark, while Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by, and when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with that Nazarene Jesus," she said. But he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about." And then he went out into the entryway. So, Peter comes in. Peter is in the courtyard. Peter is warming himself by the fire. Peter is approached by this woman, this servant girl. She says, "You were with Jesus." He denied, "I don't know or understand what you're talking about." He doesn't deny Jesus. He denies understanding what the woman is saying. Peter becomes fearful. Peter leaves the center of the courtyard and he goes back to the entryway. He goes back to the gate. Then the servant girl saw him there at the gate and said to those who were standing around, "That fellow over there is one of them." And again, he denied it. That's all that Mark says. And again, he denied it. So there are no words for Jesus in this, the second accusation. After a little while, those who were standing near to Peter said, so it was the servant girl, and now the bystanders, "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." And then we're told, he began to call down curses, and he swore to them, "I don't know this man you are talking about." Okay. That's the picture that is given in St. Mark's Gospel. Just notice in the opening line of verse 66, the tagline, "While Peter was below in the courtyard." So the assumption being that the trial of the interrogation is taking place on an upper floor or someplace higher. And that just physically, Peter was on a lower place in the courtyard. So just for your imagination to get the picture as to how these events are happening. There's a gate, there's a fire, there's a courtyard, then upstairs someplace in the building is where the trial is going on. Okay. Now it's St. Matthew. Now Peter was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him and said, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." And just as in Mark, we read, "But he denied it before them all, 'I do not know what you're talking about.'" Again, "I don't understand what you're saying." "Then he went out to the gateway," just like in Mark. He goes out to the entrance. And here it's not the same servant girl, but it's a different servant girl. "Where another servant girl saw him and said to the people, 'This fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth.'" Now in Matthew, as in Mark, he denies it, but in Matthew he speaks. And it's not that he denies understanding, but he denies the man. "I don't know the man," he says. After a little while, those standing there went up to Peter. Again, it's the bystanders. One servant girl, the second servant girl, now the bystander. The bystanders went up to Peter and said, "Surely you are one of them, for your accent gives you away." Okay. In Mark, he's a Galilean, but we aren't told how they know he's a Galilean. In Matthew, he's a Galilean, but we're told that they recognized him by his accent. Then he began to call down curses, and he swore to them, I don't know the man. Okay, now let's look at Ruth. Remember that the first of the, in Luke, the first of the denials of Peter, remember in Luke that they bring Jesus in and they hold him for trial. There is no trial, there is nothing going on with Jesus other than he is being held by the guards. So Peter comes in, servant girl sees him seated by the firelight, and she looks closely at him and says, this man was with him. Now, in reading Luke is a dramatist. The tradition says he was also an artist. Some say he was a physician. But there's a dramatic thing about Luke. Film producers who like to do the passion story like to fascinate themselves on Luke because Luke is so picturesque. Matthew and Mark have Jesus sitting by the fire warming himself. Luke has him sitting there in the firelight. The glow of the fire is playing on his face. And that is how he is recognized. That's a very dramatic thing for Hollywood. It's a wonderful cinematography piece. This man sits in the shadows and it's the firelight that plays off his face. And the woman comes and she looks closely at him. She gets right up to him and she peers at him. And then she says, presumably to the crowds, this man was with him. Peter denies it. Woman, I don't know him. Luke will give nouns of address, not necessarily proper names, but when he responds, he will address the person. A little later, someone else saw him and said, you also are one of them. This was a man, because the response is, man, I am not. About an hour later, remember, this is all night long. There's no trial going on. The trial happens in the morning, Luke. So Luke has got a whole night that he can fill with the story of the denials of Peter. So an hour later, another asserts, certainly this fellow is with them, for he is a Galilean. Peter replied, man, I don't know what you're talking about. Now, this is a unique piece of Luke. Just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. So Jesus was being held in the same place Peter was. In Luke's gospel, Jesus was brought in and Jesus was being held by the guards. He was being abused by the guards. And within that same place, Peter and other people are gathered. And throughout the night, there is this play between Peter and the servant girl or the other people, the men. And Peter ends up denying Jesus three times, and the cock crows. Remember, Jesus had said, before the cock crow, you will deny me three times. And we're told, and the Lord turned and looked, and the word intently or straight at, looked straight at Peter. And then curiously, In the other gospel stories, it's when the cock crows that Peter remembers. In Luke, it's not when the cock crows, but when Jesus looks straight at him, then Peter remembered the word of the Lord. The word of the Lord had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me three times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. Now that's a very dramatic story. Luke is much more dramatic, much more photogenic, much more artistic than Matthew or Mark is. In fact, there's this one wonderful picture, you've probably seen it sometimes in art books, sometimes on holy cards or whatever, this picture of Peter down in the, you know, artists have tried to figure out how all of this took place. And so this one artist has Peter down in the courtyard by the fire, warming himself and people standing around him. And then on the second floor, through an open window, you see Jesus gazing down on top of him. Now there's nothing in the text that says Jesus was inside a building or on the second floor. It just says that Jesus was proximate to him, was in the same place. But artists have wrestled with trying to put all of this together. Now remember in John the denial takes place, the first denial takes place before the interrogation, and then the second and third denial take place after the interrogation. So in chapter 18, verse 15, the first denial, Simon Peter and the other disciples were following Jesus because this disciple was known to the high priest. He went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside. The other disciple who was known to the high priest came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you? She asked the servant girl, the girl at the gate. I am not, Peter says. And then we're given this little aside, if you will. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around the fire they had made to keep warm. Peter was standing with them, warming himself. Okay, then in John we go into the interrogation. After the interrogation, we're told, meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there warming himself, so they asked him, you aren't one of his disciples too, are you? And again, he said, I am not. And now a piece of that's very different in John. One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off. So a relative of Malchus challenged Peter. Didn't I see you with him in the garden? So all of a sudden, Peter has been not only nailed as a disciple, but there's an eyewitness who saw Peter in the garden and presumably saw Peter slice off the ear of this man's relative. Peter denied it, and at that moment, the rooster began to crow. In St. John's Gospel, remember that Peter denies first, and then there's the confrontation between Annas and Jesus. And once Jesus gives the answer to Annas, then one of the police, is one of the translations, the New Revised Standard Version said, one of the police slap Jesus and say, is this a way to speak to the high priest? Well, Sometimes people get very offended by the scriptures. Sometimes people get very offended because they feel that the scriptures as they're being written of the time can be read into the 20th century, and being read in the 20th century, they are discriminatory. We have talked about the way the term Jew, it cannot be read in the 20th century. Well, anyway, with regard to this piece, there was a letter written not very long ago, a couple years back, by a Long Island police chief. And he had been in church on Good Friday, and he had listened to the story of the Passion. And he took great, great exception to the fact that it said that one of the police slapped Jesus. And he wrote the story, and he wrote the article, and he suggested that perhaps we should take that out, or we should rename that person, because the police have such a hard time maintaining order now anyway. Young people disregard the police. Young people don't look upon them as having any authority. Young people look upon them as not being truly law enforcement officers. And here you've got these young people in church who find that the police also slapped Jesus. So he was very upset. He wanted the word police taken out. Well, the person who responded to him, I think, tongue-in-cheek, said, well, maybe what the church ought to do is exactly what the church did with regard to the offensive language with regard to the Jews. We should have the Holy Father write a letter that says clearly some of the police at that time slapped Jesus, but clearly not all of the police slapped Jesus. And you certainly can't blame police of the 20th century for what police of the first century did. Peter's denial is strongly remembered in the early church. It has got a very, very strong place. When Paul, in his writing, describes the events that occurred, he begins by saying, on the night he was betrayed, it becomes the point of reference for Paul. Now, I find it curious that in our four Eucharistic prayers, when it comes to the point of the consecration of the bread, each one of those Eucharistic prayers situates that event differently. The first Eucharistic prayer says, the night before he suffered, he took bread. The second Eucharistic prayer says, before he was given up to death, a death he freely accepted, he took bread. The third Eucharistic prayer, which drives its source from St. Paul, says, on the night he was betrayed, he took bread. And the fourth Eucharistic prayer, while they were at supper, he took bread. But each one of those taglines in the four Eucharistic prayers, in a sense, put a different spin on how we're getting to this. What is the tagline that leads us into this? There is that piece in the Gospel, in the story, where it says that in the third questioning, the third challenging of Peter, that Peter begins to curse. He takes an oath. And people have wondered, now what kind of cursing is involved there? Some say it is a to curse is used as a reflexive or an intransitive verb, that he cursed himself. You know, I'll be damned if You know, that kind of a statement. But that's really not how that word was used. The word has an object. And what most commentators say is that what Peter did is he cursed Jesus. He damned Jesus. And we have some reference after the resurrection of the Lord in the first century that might corroborate that. A Roman author by the name of Pliny, P-L-I-N-Y, writes about Christians and writes about the ways in which he seeks to ferret out Christians. And since many of the Christian community were of the lower class, what he would do is he would find slave girls and he would ask them to point out who the Christians were and would promise them money. And then he writes and says, when anyone is accused of being a Christian, he is asked this three times. Are you a Christian? He's interrogated three times. And if the person says he is not a Christian, then the person must curse Jesus. And then Pliny says, for no Christian would do that. So the cursing of Jesus, at least in the very early century, became kind of a term for betraying the faith. And that's what in the mind of some of those scripture authors is exactly what Peter did. Peter betrayed the faith in Jesus. Now it's in St. John's Gospel that the rehabilitation of Peter takes place on the Sea of Galilee, on the shore of the shoreline after the resurrection. And Jesus asks Peter three times, Peter, do you love me? And three times Peter answers, yes, you know I love you. And in St. John's Gospel, that is the scene, if you will, of the reverse side of the betrayal of the cursing. The three times he was asked, and three times he denied, now three times he is asked, and three times he affirms. Now there's the piece of the cock crow. You know, there are all these little pieces in there, you know. The pieces of the cock crow. Mark alone says, before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times. It's only in Mark that there is the number of times. Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times. The other gospels simply say, before the cock crows. Now in pagan writing, the second crowing of the cock means the end of a period of time. So to say, before the cock crows twice, may be nothing more than saying that late in the night, you will deny me three times. Now the Roman time was divided, the night was divided into four categories, into four pieces. From 9 o'clock on, it was called evening. At midnight was the second watch. At 3 o'clock was what was called cock crow, the third watch. And at 6 o'clock was called daybreak. So Evening began at 9 o'clock. At midnight was the second watch. At 3 o'clock was the third watch. And then the fourth watch was at 6 o'clock in the morning. So in the minds of the evangelists, the betrayal of Peter took place sometime between midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, scripture scholars have always tried to be more precise about that. Well, okay, between midnight and three, but when between midnight and three did this happen? Well, at the end of the last century, the end of the 1800s, there was a wonderful scripture teacher, a Dominican priest by the name of Barry Lagrange, and he lived in Jerusalem. And for a number of nights, the poor man stayed up all night trying to record when he heard the cock crow. And it was very frustrating for him because the time was different every night. There was no set time. Well, Cicero says in one of his letters, the cock will crow whenever the cock chooses to crow. That there is no set time for the cock to crow. Interestingly, though, there was a prohibition at the time of Jesus that chickens were not to be kept in Jerusalem. At least they were not to be kept near the temple. And for obvious reasons. I mean, they make a mess. So, that the chickens were to be kept on the outskirts. The cock crow has, again, captures the imagination. It's a dramatic touch. In the 4th century, we have a record of liturgy for Good Friday, and it says that in some places, that the sounding of the cock crowing was actually brought in part of the liturgy of Good Friday. So you would have a procession, you would bring in the cross, and you would bring in the crown of thorns, and you would bring in the spear, and you would bring in the nails, and then you would have this rooster crowing as part of the procession that comes into church. Now, people have said, now, did he really deny three times, or did he deny six times, or did he deny two times? What's this three times business? Well, in telling stories, in telling narratives, there is what is called the rule of three. When you tell a story, when you need to bring a point, when you need to build to a point, and when you have to have contrast, the rule for composition says that three is the normal number of times effective in telling a story. Well, you know, have you heard this one about the Frenchman, the German, and the Italian? You know, and then you do one, two, three. Or have you heard this one about the priest, the Protestant minister, and the Jewish rabbi? You know, one, two, three.
Pat Megan Mustard.
That's right. And the third one always is kind of the punchline. The third one is always the what you're building toward. Well, in the scriptures, there are many stories that are told, or many events that are told that apply to the rule of three. For instance, the story about the talents. Jesus gives a person 10 talents and 5 talents and 1 talent. And then the person comes back and the 10 person has, you know, gained 10 more, the 5 person has gained 5 more. But the punchline has to do with the one person who buries it. The one person who buries it, who says, you're a hard man. There are three groups that come to the cross, you know. The authorities, the chief priests, the rulers. There are the mob, and then there are the criminals, who all have speaking parts at the cross. You know, what this may mean is that the texts that we have, the scriptures that we have, the story that we have been through a period of history where they were narrative and not written down. And that what is written down is the product of a narrative tradition. So as people would have told the story, it's not inconceivable that to make the story more picturesque or more exciting or more whatever, they would have used the norms or the tools that are used in narrative storytelling. So that when it comes down to us as a written piece, it comes down with all of that, all of those qualities of a narrative. That doesn't say there weren't three denials, but it says it's maybe not necessary to insist that there were three denials. Although it comes down to us in all four of the Gospels of that story, the three denials, and it builds to the third one. Because this is where the clearest denial and the cursing and the swearing takes place and the cock crows. So it builds to the third one. Okay. It's interesting, in St. John's Gospel, he never says that Peter wept. Matthew, Mark, and Luke say that. Now, in Matthew's Gospel, there is a piece that happens immediately after the denial of Peter that doesn't take place in any of the other Gospels. He kind of leads us down the side street to see an event that that is not recorded anywhere. Where has Judas been while all this has been going on? Well, he's following Jesus. He's there. He sees that Jesus is condemned, and then he repents. When Judas had betrayed him, saw that Jesus had been condemned. So he witnessed something. He was on the outskirts. He was there, peering in, watching what was going on. He was seized with remorse, and he returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. I have sinned, he said. I have betrayed innocent blood. You know, it's interesting, this would be an interesting homily to preach. No place does it say that Peter repented. He went out and he wept. But the authors do say that Judas repented. Just a curious touch. It's only in Matthew that the 30 pieces of silver are mentioned. That number. Judas says, I have sinned against innocent blood. What is innocent blood? In Jewish law, if the Jewish judge sentences a person to death, that judge is responsible for that person's blood, it says. And if the judgment has been, he's responsible to that person's blood before God. If the judgment is true judgment, then it is to his glory. If the judgment is false judgment, it is to his shame. Now the only correction that is given of that, if the person is innocent, But the judge is told a lie and finds the person guilty and condemns them to death. Then the judge is not responsible. The blood is not on the judge's head. Rather, the blood is on the head of the person who lied. The image of innocent blood runs through the scriptures. It begins with Cain and Abel. Cain kills his brother Abel, and we're told that the blood of the just man Abel cried out. The image is that guilt around the killing of innocent people is a guilt that can't be shaken off. What really haunts Matthew's gospel is that who is responsible for the innocent blood of Jesus? Judas will try to get out of it. The chief priests will try to get out of it. Pilate will try to get out of it. That there are all kinds of people in the story in Matthew's gospel where people try to excuse themselves. You know, the chief priests tell Judas Judas says, I have sinned against innocent blood. And they said, what's that got to do with us? That's your responsibility. And then Judas takes the money and he throws the money into the temple and he leaves. And then we're told he went out and he hanged himself. And then the chief priest picked up the coins and says, it would be against the law to put this into the treasury since it's blood money. They're willing to excuse themselves from being participants in the death of Jesus, but they aren't willing to excuse themselves to use the money. They don't want to touch the money. So they decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. That is why it has been called the Field of Blood to this day. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field as the Lord commanded me. Now there are two citations in the Old Testament that talk about this field of blood. The first is from the end of Zechariah. Remember, we went to the end of Zechariah a number of times earlier. It is the just shepherd who is talking. If it seems right to you, give me my wages, but if not, keep them. And so they weighed out as my wages 30 pieces of silver. Then the Lord said to me, throw it into the treasury. This lordly price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and I threw them into the treasury, into the house of the Lord. So we've got Judas throwing the 30 pieces of silver into the temple. Now, there are various texts in the scriptures that say he threw them into the temple treasury, or he threw them into the temple pottery, into the kiln that was in the temple. And some would say, throwing it into the pottery is the origin of the potter's field, known as the field of blood. For in Jeremiah it says, the Lord said to me, go and buy a potter's earthenware jug. Take it with you, some of the elders of the people and some of the senior priests, and go to the valley of the son of Hinnom, at the entry of the potter's shed gate, and proclaim there the words that I tell you. This place will no longer be called Topheth, or the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of the slaughter, the field of blood. The second piece about this story is the the end of Judas. Judas hanging himself. There are references to this piece of Judas hanging himself in the New Testament, apart from the Gospels, in the Acts of the Apostles. In first chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, Peter stands up, and before the election of Matthias, it says, in those days, Peter stood up among the believers, together the crowd numbered about 120 people, and he said, friends, the scriptures had to be fulfilled, which the Holy Spirit through David foretold concerning Judas, who became a guide for those who arrested Jesus. For he was numbered among us and was allotted his share in the ministry. And then in parentheses it says, now this man acquired a field with the reward of his wickedness. So in the Acts of the Apostles, it's not the chief priest who buys the field, but it's Judas who buys the field. This man acquired a field with the reward of his wickedness, and then falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. This became known to all the residents of Jerusalem, so that the field was called in their language Hekeldama, that means the field of blood. So, in the Acts of the Apostles, it is Judas who buys the field. And this incredibly gruesome image of his death. You know, the scripture says, and the gospel says, he went out and hanged himself. But in the Acts of the Apostles, it says, he falls headlong, and he ruptures, and his bowels spill out. It's a fairly yucky kind of image. Well, that image is found in the second book of Maccabees. There's a character named Antiochus who is probably the wickedest person in all of Scripture. He is the only person who kills Jews simply because they're Jews. And he faces a death that is pretty disgusting. Speaking of Antiochus, it says, the all-seeing Lord, the God of Israel, struck him down with an unseen but incurable blow. For scarcely had he uttered these words when he was seized with an excruciating pain in his bowels and a sharp internal torment. This was a fit punishment for him who had tortured the bowels of others with many barbarous torments. Far from giving up his insolence, he was all the more filled with arrogance, and breathing fire in his rage against the Jews, he gave orders to drive the chariot even faster. And as a result, he hurled from the dashing chariot, and every part of his body was racked by the violent fall. Thus he who previously, in his superhuman presumption, thought he could command the waves of the sea and imagine that he weighed the mountains in his scales, was now thrown to the ground and had to be carried on a litter, clearly manifesting to all the power of God. This body of this evil man swarmed with worms, and while he was still alive in hideous torments, his flesh rotted off, so that the entire army was sickened by the stench of his corruption. Shortly before, he had thought that he would reach the stars of heaven, and now no one could endure to transport the man because of his intolerable stench. At last, broken in spirit, he began to give up his excessive arrogance and to gain some understanding under the scourge of God, for he was racked with pain. When he could no longer bear his own stench, he said, it is right to be the subject to God and not to think one's mortal self as divine. He had regarded himself as divine. Then this vile man vowed to the Lord that he would no longer have mercy on him, that he would set free the holy city toward which he had been hurrying with the intention of leveling it to the ground and making it a graveyard. He would put on perfect equality with the Athenians, all of the Jews, whom he had judged not even worthy of burial. He would adorn with the finest offerings the holy temple, which he had previously despoiled, and he would restore the sacred vessels. Besides all of this, he would become a Jew himself. But since God's punishment had justly come upon him, his sufferings were not lessened. So he lost hope for himself, and he wrote the following letter to the Jews in the form of a supplication. It read thus, "The death of Antiochus. To my esteemed Jewish citizen, Antiochus, their king and general, sends greeting. If you and your children are well and your affairs are doing as you wish, I thank God very much. Now that I am ill, I recall with affection the esteem and goodwill you have borne me. Actually, I do not despair of my health, since I have great hopes of recovery." This is the guy whose body is rotting. "I know that my father, whenever he went on campaigns in the hinterland, would name his successor, so that if anything unexpected should happen, the people throughout the realm would know whom the government had been entrusted to. I am also bearing in mind that the neighboring rulers, especially those on the borders of our kingdom, are on watch for opportunities and waiting to see what will happen. Therefore, I beg and entreat you to remember the general and individual benefits you have received, and to continue to show goodwill toward me and my son. I am confident that following my policy, he will treat you with kindness, and he will treat you with kindness." Following this letter, the man falls to the ground, his bowels gush open, and he dies. Now, this story is an incredibly graphic and a very well-understood story. People aren't going to miss the connection between him and Judas. I mean, it is a way of saying, it's a way of the early church authors saying, Judas is the personification of evil. For the early church, Judas's death was seen as God's punishment. Judas betrayed innocent blood. Judas is seen against the background of the Old Testament and of the stories of evil people who died violent deaths. The name Judas is a curious name. Judas comes from Judah, as does the word Jude, J-U-D-E, as does the word Jew, J-E-W. There are 12 sons of Jacob. One of them is named Judah. He is the one who gets involved in the selling of his brother Joseph to the Median travelers. And in some accounts, in some texts of the book of Genesis, the price that is paid for Joseph is 30 pieces of silver. So he is seen as, if you will, the fulfillment of Judah, the son of Jacob. And that his selling of Jesus for 30 pieces of silver is seen as the fulfillment of Judah's selling his son, or his brother Joseph, for 30 pieces of silver. In many other accounts, in many other texts, it's 20 pieces of silver. But 20 or 30 is, as I mentioned, it's only one place in the four Gospels that the number 30 is assigned to the silver. The others just say that he was given money to do this. Okay, we've gone over time. That's the end of the Judas story, and we're going to pick up with Pilate and the Roman trial, and then move on to the crucifixion next time. Okay. Any questions anybody has? Oh, population. Probably not very large normally. Maybe 50, 60, 70,000 people normally. That'd be Jerusalem and the environs. But at time of Passover, that could be quadrupled. There could be 250,000 people in the city, because they would come in from all over. And that's why the Roman garrison would be put there, to control the crowds. That the Roman garrison regularly was not in Jerusalem. It would be offensive to the Jews to have Romans Roman soldiers quartered in the holy city. So the Roman garrison was up the coast in the town of Caesarea, named after Caesar, on the coast, and that's where Pilate's residence was. That's where the governor lived. The governor would come down with his cohorts to maintain order, and there was a residence in town that he would stay at while he was there. And that's the residence, the Praetorium, the place of the garrisoning, the place they garrisoned the soldiers, that they would bring Jesus for trial. But his residence was up north. It would have been unseemly. Now, he did some fairly unseemly things. He insisted, and this is blasphemous, but the Jewish authorities agreed, he insisted that the eagle, the symbol of Roman imperialism, be placed on the wall of the temple. And the chief priests allowed it to happen. And so part of the, I mentioned earlier that there were various factions among the Jews, and some of them were purists, and some of them were laissez-faire, and, it was very different. And Jesus was regarded as being one of those insurgents, one of those people who would cause a riot. Well, the people who caused a riot were right-wing people. I mean, they wanted purity of religion. They didn't want any mixing with anybody. So these people were very, very upset that things like the Roman eagle would be on the face of the temple. They didn't want any of that mixing of cultures and mixing of religions. But again, the chief priests, and especially Caiaphas, who was able to hang on for 15 years, he found a way of accommodation. He found a way to get along and work with it. And so he allowed it to happen. In exchange, he got certain privileges himself, and the people got certain privileges. But it was a give and take. And the purists didn't want any give and take. The purists wanted it just as it was. So at the time of festivals, of holidays, there were going to be more of these people around and more tension around and more possible upheaval and revolution around. And so Pilate would come down with his garrison. But otherwise it was, in ancient times, 50, 60, 70,000 people was no small number. Oh, Nazareth could easily have been, a few hundred folk. Like Function Junction. Okay.